This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, mentors, wizards and wise women, portrayals of the elderly in speculative fiction.
Oh my god!
In stereo.
Jules, you've spoiled everything.
I'm sorry. Right, so please carry on.
you spoke first and you used my signature starting word, which is so.
It just makes me think of Richard III, where, you know, the now speech.
Yeah.
Now is the winter of our discontent.
Our discontent.
Turn to glorious summer. Yeah, anyway. Sorry about that. This one's really your baby, your idea.
It is. But I also feel, considering information that we've learned in previous episodes about you and the kind of characters you like, this is going to be a topic which will tickle your interests. And which you will probably have a lot to say about.
Yes. Well, no, I was trying to think of examples of elderly characters in speculative fiction, particularly for books for younger people, mm-hmm. where I found them quite stereotypical and they've been swept out of the narrative really quickly. And I have to be honest, I can't think of any off the top of my head. So either they were so minimal as characters that I just didn't register them, which is not good, or I've just been a bit lucky and I've read books where the older characters have stayed with me.
Well, it's more along the lines of, very often in speculative fiction you don't tend to get elderly characters as the main characters. They tend to be support.
Yeah.
And there was a book I read, and I think it's Ian Colfer, called The Wish List.
Not one I've read.
I think that's what it's called. I read it a very, very long time ago. Actually, I'm just going to check it out. The Wish List, Ian Colfer, which is about a girl named Meg Finn, who dies, and she can't get into heaven or into hell because her good points and her bad points are both even. So she's sent back to Earth to kind of do good in order to earn her place into heaven. But I think there are things which are trying to thwart her in that so that she can go to hell. And what happens is that she robbed an elderly gentleman named Lowry McCall. And she robbed him, and he's a pensioner. And she ends up going back to see him and sort of to help him around. And I think she possesses him. And it's just the two of them. But it is told a lot from Lowry's point of view.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd ever read a young adult book, or a children's book, where the main character really was an older man. I mean, obviously, it's pretty typical that if you're going to read young adult and children, the main characters are going to be those ages. But yeah, it was the first time I'd read anything like that. And it was really interesting, actually.
I think there's something about physical age being an issue as well. Because you have characters in speculative fiction who are old, but for some reason they're either trapped in this eternal youth or eternal sort of, you know, early middle age or whatever.
Yeah.
They've not reached the stage where they are physically declining.
Yeah, it's true.
Or the perceived physical decline anyway.
Yeah. But I think another good example is the film Up.
Yeah.
Again, we have a main character who is a pensioner. And that was very interesting. But the thing that I remarked was that both of these narratives follow kind of crotchety old men. And for some reason, they're crotchety and they're single. But
probably because they're crotchety.
crotchety, you know, they're crotchety because, you know, their wife or significant other has died or something like that. But yeah, they're very crotchety. And actually, Up was a really interesting film because despite the fact he's a pensioner, this is a man with agency and physical ability as well. I mean, he does actually, he gets quite far, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's interesting about that because he lives an entire life with, obviously, his wife in the prologue of that film. And the prologue's a bit of that film that a lot of children actually find quite boring. But they have no problem engaging with an older character for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I think that prologue was one of the bits that I found the most utterly heartbreaking.
I know, it is. It gets me every single time.
I cried from the start of that movie to the end.
But, you know, for children, they tend to find that a bit slow going and not really part of the entire plot, as it were. They're more interested once it gets going.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting perspective, I think, from the very young to the very old. Old people are generally portrayed as either mentors or obstacles, I suppose.
Yeah, and they do tend to hold that role, that they're not very often sort of main characters. And I guess, yeah, that there is an element of ability. So do they have the physical ability to be doing all of the stuff that you need the main character to be doing? But also, you know, can we associate with these people? And I feel kind of like old people, it's easier for children to associate with the elderly than it is for children to associate with adults.
Yeah, I think there's an element of truth in that. I can't entirely put my finger on why. I think perhaps there's enough of a gap that there's a fascination there on both sides.
Yeah. I also think that it's because adults become very occupied by societal obligations and rules. And actually, as you get older, you kind of, your world almost gets a little bit smaller again.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, you don't have to work. Well, you might have to work. That's, you know, that's actually a bigger, that's not true. In this day, you might very well be working forever. But, you know, there's this kind of, this separation a little bit from the kind of the obligation line. You know, the parents, grandparents will treat children differently to how they treated their own children. So they treat their grandchildren differently to how they treated their own children.
Yeah.
I tend to find. And I think there's this lessening of responsibility a little bit, and this kind of liberty, which isn't necessarily a good kind of liberty, but it is this freedom, which comes with kind of retirement.
Well, okay, assuming that retirement is actually available, I'm probably going to die in harness.
Yeah, me too. But I mean, the reason I guess I wanted to do the topic is that I, you know, I was looking at all of these depictions of pensioners and co in fiction. And they do have very kind of limited roles, and then, you know, say, oh, it is the physical ability. And my dad, it's actually the day that we are recording this, it's his birthday. So happy birthday, Dad. And he's over 60 and he climbs mountains.
Yeah.
I cannot climb mountains. I'm 24. Going to be 25. I cannot climb mountains. I have no desire to climb mountains. My dad climbs mountains, and he does yoga, and he just did Kilimanjaro, and he's off to do base camp of Everest. So this is a person who has more physical ability than I do. And I'm prime protagonist, you know, age. I'm ready emotionally. But yeah, this is a man. And it was actually funny because he went to pick something up from the sort of the pharmacist. And the pharmacist said, oh, are you on any medication? And my dad went, nope. And the guy looked at him and he was there like, no medication at all. He's there like, nope, none at all. And he's like, how have you managed to get this far and be on no medication? And my dad was just like, I'm a healthy human being. So I guess that's probably what prompted me to suddenly go, actually, it would be interesting to see fiction kind of engage with the elderly and people of an older age in a way that it isn't doing at the moment, because I think there's this big separation with age groups, which is actually to the detriment of our society. When we were growing up, people were really surprised by the fact that my family all ate dinner together. I had friends who said, I can't believe that, you actually talk to your parents, and that my dad goes to Glastonbury with my brother, and that, we were brought up to be able to communicate with people of a different sort of generation to us. And so many people aren't. And I honestly think there is this big problem with how we treat the elderly in this country, and in Western society.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, I am actually a different generation to you, but obviously, it was, you sit and eat together at the table, and that seems to be quite a big thing. And I was quite close to both my grandmothers. Both of my grandfathers died before I was born, but I met a lot of my great aunts and my great uncles in Ireland, and yeah, I wouldn't say it's like learning a different language or anything, but having the expectation there that you will communicate with somebody who's much older has been quite important. And the reason I've realised it's important is that, okay, bit of backstory now. With the library, I'm helping spearhead what they call the Memory Project, which is where we've collected memories from people in the local area, mostly elderly people from various things. And we've gone round and we've interviewed them and we've talked to them and we've collected the memories and made sure that they're happy with them, and they're going to be presented and available in the libraries for people to read and hear about. And to bring in the other side of this, to bring in the very young people, we've got them to come in and read, and I've recorded them reading these memories by older people to sort of close that circle. And it's going to be released as a podcast from the
That's
library
awesome.
service. And it was really interesting, and I found I had no trouble at all engaging with teenagers. And okay, partly that's a lot of experience of teaching teenagers karate and things like that, but I didn't have any trouble with them at all. And again, I know there are some libraries that have difficulty with groups of teenagers coming round, and I think obviously it depends a bit on the group of teenagers. But I had a potentially troublesome group, and took the wind out of their sails a bit. By basically just inviting them in the library. There's a long story there, but and it was weird. They came in and they sort of giggled and they, made rude noises, and they tried to push the boundaries a bit, and I just let them get on with it. And then the next week they came back again, and the week after that they came back and brought a few more friends. Quite often now I have 15 to 20 of them sat in the, the PC children's area. And they text each other to say, yeah, we're meeting at the library. And I think part of the reason I don't have any problem communicating with sort of younger people or communicating with children as well is the fact that, that early indoctrination of, no, you'll speak to people who are older than you, and you'll speak to adults, and you'll speak to people younger. It's not just sticking with your own kind, as it were.
I do feel that there is this. Yeah, it's a two-way street. It's not just that a lot of people of my generation, and when I say this, I'm not trying to say that all the people of my generation are incapable of communicating with their grandparents or their parents. That's not true at all. I know so many people who love their grandparents to bits, and are very close to them. It's not about that. It's more about the way that society kind of has separated age groups, and how, what's the word? The media, and how our sort of our fiction has separated age groups and sort of given them roles. And I think it's so refreshing when you see books or films that actually change that narrative a little bit, or that sort of actually show the real true diversity of character that you have. I mean, not everyone who is above the age of 60 is crotchety, or very benign or evil,
No,
which is,
They're just people as well.
Some of them are just people, but they have good sides, they have bad sides, you know. But it seems to be that sort of those kinds of, we limit ourselves into the kind of characters we can have by limiting the age groups that we allow into our stories that we're willing to follow. And it's the case that, and I think possibly a large part of that is, you know, children's fiction, where I'm completely for having children's fiction where with child characters, you know, that makes total sense. But I also think that there should be children's fiction which doesn't just have children. I mean, one good example, Roald Dahl. I know you have some misgivings about Roald Dahl, and you know, that's fair. But, you know, what is it, Mr. and Mrs. Twit?
Yes.
Yeah, but they're not kids. It's just a story about these two awful people, but it's funny.
Yeah, I've obviously mentioned Robin Jarvis before, but he has some really great adult characters. There's Alice Boston, who's a 92-year-old in the Whitby Witches series.
Yeah.
And she is the Whitby Witch, you know, the head of the coven, so to speak. And she's an absolutely brilliant character. She's got loads of autonomy. She's got loads of agency. She knows her own mind. She's the one who solves all the mysteries. The children are actually really helping her.
Yeah. It makes me think of, obviously it's not speculative fiction, but Miss Marple.
Yes.
Who was actually a fantastic character because everyone stereotyped her as the old darling woman with the twitching curtains, you know. Yeah. And she sort of went along with it, like, oh, I wouldn't possibly presume. And then she was like, boom, solve murder. She always, like, figured it out, like, giving this wry sort of smile, like, oh, yes, 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 I'll just get on with my knitting, shall I, whilst I do your jobs for you.
No, she's great. As one character describes her, you know, best disguise in the world, looks like a sweet little old lady, mind like a bacon slicer.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. But when I try to think of, at least when I say modern, I mean in the last, you know, few years, examples of speculative fiction which have starred people of an older generation, you know, pensioners or anything like that, I really struggle to find any. And then Logan has just come out.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet. I am quite excited to see it. But I think that has the potential to address certain things which are not very often addressed in the superhero, especially the superhero genre.
Yeah, I have seen it and I really liked it. And it does, because whatever timeline they're on, and they're not very specific, you've got Professor X is a nonagenarian in that. And he's suffering from dementia.
Yeah.
Of some form. They're not too specific. But it's really interesting. If you think you've got this person with this most incredible, powerful mind and something that makes it misfire really badly.
Yeah. And Logan himself is not young in that.
No, he's not. I mean, you're not supposed to think he's old as such, but certain things are happening and he's not regenerating in the same way. Something is poisoning him.
Yeah. So it's, again, it's, maybe it's something that we're going to be seeing more of now. And when we consider that the, you know, the superhero genre is very much aimed toward young adults, and that's not true, it's not just young adults, but they have a big young adult audience. It's nice to see that. And I like to see a little bit more of it.
Yeah. One of the best, going probably slightly off on a tangent.
No.
What I liked about Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy was the fact that you get the sense in the book that Gandalf and Saruman are old, but you never really see that age in the same way as you do. Yeah. As you do when in that, what is actually quite a gritty, scary fight between two pensioners.
Yes.
It's like, no, they're seriously going for it with each other.
It looks and really painful.
they look like old men, you know. It's two old men knocking each other about. And Gandalf's getting his arse handed to him. It's, you know, it's nasty stuff. And obviously Gandalf's very powerful, but compared to Saruman at that point in time. And then later on, it's only when you see Saruman's broken body in the, I think it's the third film, isn't it, that you think, well, actually he was an old man all the time, but he's never given you that feeling in the same way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he didn't pull any punches when it came to character age.
It was the other thing about Gandalf is that he, as a character, does... Well, he's not necessarily that mental character. In fact, he's more of an instigator of terrible things.
He's sort of an enabler, isn't he? And he's very much, he's going to go his own way and follow his own morality. I wouldn't say he tries to force his morality on anybody else, but he will stop them doing things if he thinks they're really stupid or immoral. He'll try to.
I mean, this is not a man who says, no, you must be, you know, this is a man who is like, hey, Bilbo, here's a bunch of dwarves. Go on an adventure. Wake a dragon. You only live once. YOLO. And then deserts them halfway through.
Yeah, it's like, oh, he'll be all right.
He'll be fine. Like, no.
Enough of him to make a smear on the dragon's beak, but you can't do it.
So it's, you know, he's an interesting character. And I think in a similar way, in your book, in Unveiled, you have Mary Cranford.
Yes.
Who's in her 80s. And she's a fantastic character because she starts off with this kind of, well, I mean, like, she's a woman with a lot of agency. She's very strong. And she starts off pretending, kind of, in a way, to be that guiding, you know, she's there as the mentor kind of person. But you quickly get the impression that this is a woman who is not a bad person, but she has her own agenda.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And there's the whole thing where she, you know, she, certainly at the start of I Belong to the Earth, you've got her out on a walking stick. She doesn't need to use it at all. Emlyn is saying, I don't understand. Why has she got a walking stick? She's actually pulling me up the road faster than I can walk, kind of thing at one point. And she sort of gets a little bit of a kick out of appearing weaker than she really is. I think that there's a sly tricksterness about her that enjoys deceiving people.
Yeah, and she's definitely a very playful character, which I really, really like about her. Because she's playful but not vicious necessarily. Though she definitely does punish shallow people.
Yes.
In many ways. Which is, I liked her as a character, you know, I like her as a character. She's a very interesting character. And as I said, she's dynamic. You can believe her. You can believe that she's a real person. She's not just a generic, needed old person here, insert. You know? So yeah. I like her as a character. I can genuinely feel that this is a woman who has a story.
How did you feel... Okay, just generally interested, this is from I Am the Silence. How did you feel about Edie Gillis in comparison then?
I liked Edie. I liked her as well. Obviously, we didn't get that much of her. And I liked her frailty mixed with her badassery. Because she was pretty cool.
Yeah. She's very much not well-intentioned in the same way, though.
No. But then the thing is, she's not pretending to be either.
No, that's true.
You know, she's actually pretty open about what she is and who she is. She's just happy to be herself, which is nice. So it's, these are sort of interesting characters. And, you know, I know that in the next book as well, we're going to be introduced to another character who is older as well.
Yeah, George Sanders.
Yeah, so we won't go into that too much, but it's just nice because, again, these are not, he's not, they're not there as characters just to sort of push the plot along. I mean, they are there to push the plot along in some ways, but they're not just needed that person there pushing the plot along, now I can remove them. These are people who you could genuinely believe are the heroes of their own story.
Yeah, and that is what that's what I was going for, but I think part of it is that I've found that certainly through working with the library service and through the NHS and that, there are so many people who get sort of sidelined because they're older and people think, oh, well, you know, they don't really know anything. They're time travellers. They don't really understand where they are, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whether they've got dementia or any of any kind or not. And actually, there's some really interesting stories there.
Yeah.
Really, really fascinating stuff. There's one lady who comes to the library club. She's well over 100 years old and she remembers both world wars.
I was walking with my grandmother one day in France, in Savignin, and she suddenly pointed up to a cluster of trees in the little forested area, and she said, that is where I hid when the Nazis came.
Yeah, it's a real sort of eye-opening moment, isn't it?
It is. It's, and I think the other thing is that they give a sense of time, because... Yeah. So often, you know, we think of things happening long ago. Oh, World War II, it was a long time ago. And then my grandmother, you know, turns around and says, oh yeah, I was sent to boarding school because my mother was hiding the resistance and Jews in the house. So she was sent off to boarding school so that if the Nazis ever found them, the Nazis were prone to just shooting everyone on sight so that they wouldn't find this little girl. And I just thought, my God, it's there. It's in living memory. It's right there.
Yeah.
And you know, my grandmother is an incredibly sharp person who has these amazing stories, and they kind of connect you with so much. And I just think it's a shame that we've been disconnected from that. And we've kind of, it's not actually by volition, you know, we've kind of been conditioned to be disconnected from each other. And it is both ways, you know. Children sometimes have difficulty connecting with people who are older than them. And by the same token, people who are older have difficulty connecting with children, because I think when you stop trying to engage with the modern world, that's when things start to go downhill. And it's about kind of meeting this middle ground, really.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I just think a lot of people aren't willing to try and meet that middle ground.
It is interesting in writing terms, though, because if you're writing young adult or something with a very young, youngish protagonist, you kind of do need to get the parent figures out of the way long enough for them to have agency of their own.
Yet, interestingly enough, very often... I find that when you've got the parent figures out of the way, what tends to happen is that they end up being in the care of older women.
Yeah.
So an example of that, James Nichols' Apprentice Witch.
Yeah. Diana Wynne Jones is Fire and Hemlock. You've got Granny, who is a fabulous character.
Yeah. So that, yeah, there's grandmother, there's granny. Another example is, I saw a film and I cannot for the life of me remember what it's called, like Time After Time or something like that, about a young boy during World War One or Two who gets sent to live with his grandmother, and he discovers that the house that they're in is haunted, and he kind of connects with the children who lived there from the past and sort of goes on adventures with them. Sort of. And it's, you know, it's a fantastic film. But again, it's that connection where he gets with his grandmother, which is, again, is very, very interesting, because it's sort of acceptable to get rid of the parents. But yeah. It's just like, no, they're too sensible. Get rid of them. But you can have the grandmother, because the grandmother is kind of a little bit more sort of willing to. The grandmother is the one who has the stories. I remember in my day with the little folk who came up in the garden, we don't go there. And, you know, the grandmother is always the superstitious one.
See, that's made it sound like my grandmother was actually out of a speculative fiction novel of some kind.
I have said this time and time again, Jules. You need to just, you know what? You and I, we're going to sit down and we're just going to record every single story that you remember from your grandmother. And I'm going to record a bunch of stories from, we're going to go around and we're going to collect stories from grandmothers about the crazy stuff that happens.
Oh God, yeah. There's a couple that wouldn't be suitable for a podcast.
I'm talking about we collect them into a book and then publish it. This Halloween, I'm telling you, you need to sit down, have story time with Jules. Story time with Jules. It'll be great.
Yeah, as I've said before, I think our listeners would be bored.
I don't think so. I think we have a special Halloween episode. We'll put on some like music and you'll tell little stories and I'll react.
Okay.
You can be a proper Shanahi.
Yes.
Anyway, the point is that you do get that role of the old woman who knows about the mysterious things that the parents dismiss.
Yeah. And I suppose really that's an archetype that has its roots in our sort of history as
yeah.
you know, human families, I suppose, because quite often the women outlive the men.
Yeah.
So if once you got past childbearing age, you actually had a pretty good chance of not dying of anything and living to a ripe old age, because the biggest killer would have been childbirth at one stage.
Yeah.
So if you managed to outlive that, and then you had your village wise woman or cunning woman or handy woman, as they were called, which incidentally my great-great-grandmother was a handy woman, basically helped with the births, the deaths, the laying outs, that sort of thing.
Gosh.
Simple herbal cures and things. And my great-great-great-grandmother was actually known as a village, I don't want to say village wise woman, I won't use the Irish word, but basically that. And
that's so cool.
She was a tiny little woman who kept pigs and gave out herbal remedies and things. So there you go, long tradition of it. But yeah, going back to what I was saying, that it is an archetype for a reason. That's been there for a long time. It's only really in the last couple of generations where we've become disconnected with our families and our extended mm-hmm. families to that extent.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, actually a part of the reason why that's happened is possibly because of that big movement that sort of encouraged people to leave home young.
Yeah.
And I think and the sort of the freedom of movement that we've achieved via easy travel means that people no longer necessarily stay in the places where they were born. And I mean, obviously, that it's been happening for a while, that, you know, we have a lot of immigration stories for a very, very long, long time. But it was fairly usual that if you had a family who, and you had several children, a couple of them might move away, you know, especially if you had daughters, they might move away with their husbands, or like one might go off to sort of Australia to find their fortune or something along those lines. But you would usually have a few family members who stayed close by.
Yeah.
And they certainly wouldn't be leaving at 18 or 19, you know?
No, or you know, there'd be connections where you'd be going back, or you'd be sending money back.
Exactly.
Speaking of my Irish grandmother again, she left school at 14 and started working as a chambermaid. And then when she was 19, she moved to England because there were more jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that, and in a way, that was unusual because not many, bearing in mind she was one of 14 brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
I think only one other moved technically over the sea. So it was unusual for her to have the gumption and the autonomy to go and do that. But she went back regularly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the sort of the movement of you got to get out and gain your independence as quickly as possible has kind of actually caused a rift, because it starts to sort of it perpetrates this idea of inconvenience. You know, I'm an inconvenience if I stay. My parents are an inconvenience to my adult life. You know, the things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas historically, actually, living in the same house, bringing your new wife or your new husband to the same house, this was not an uncommon thing. And sort of growing up and staying in that house, or staying in the area, or just going next door, that was not unusual. And what I mean, what it was, is that basically you were your parents' pension. You know, you were their insurance. When they got old and could no longer work, you were the ones who were then taking care of them.
Yeah.
And then you sort of basically took over the house. And what's happened is that we move out very quickly now. we're encouraged to by society. It says, no, you've got to get out, otherwise, you know, you're a burden, you're an inconvenience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or you don't have your independence if you still live with your parents, which I think is a bit of a silly thing to say. If you're still reliant on your parents when you are able-bodied and capable of work, then there might be an issue of, well, why aren't you helping out a little bit? But it's a complicated matter. No one should be judged because you don't know what's going on. I don't. This whole separation has basically meant that people don't have the same kind of relationships with their grandparents, and people don't have the same relationship with their parents that they did before.
Yeah, there is a disintegration of extended family bonds there.
Yeah.
And you can see it because if you compare it with cultures that have very, very strong family sensibilities, they sort of look at you very strangely when you say, well, no, of course I don't live with my grandparents, or of course my grandparents aren't just down the road. Or in my case, when I say,
Yeah.
well, actually all my grandparents are dead, they're sort of, oh my God, I'm so sorry, my dear.
Yeah. And one of my grandparents lives, my French grandfather passed away and my English grandmother passed away. So one lives up north, up north. It's north for me. It's Cheshire. It's north for me. Anything north of London is north to me. And my grandmother lives in France, and I like to think I'm quite close to my French grandmother especially. But a part of me, because I was raised abroad and because I lived in all sorts of places, missed out on the fact that I didn't have a family unit. So when I did get to see my grandparents, there was this kind of magical element to it because, we were living in the Middle East, and then we'd go to France, and France was, fantastic as far as I was concerned, because, I wasn't used to the architecture, I wasn't used to the castles, and, France had a very distinctive feel for me. So it was a very magical experience, which I think is something that a lot of people share, where they go and visit, their grandparents. They go and visit granny and grandpa when they're little, and their grandparents spoil them because they don't get to see them very often.
Yeah.
But I think what happens is that as and so y young children develop very strong relationships with their grandparents, and then actually c what can sometimes happen is that teenagers, and as you get a little bit older, that connection sort of drops a tiny bit because teenagers are more engaged with what's modern. And also at this stage, the grandparents have gotten at least 10 years older, so they can't
Yeah.
run around in the same way. They're going to struggle to sort of keep up with what's modern, and this kind of gap appears, which disconnects people.
And of course, as a teenager, you should be focusing on moving forward and attaining some independence and
Exactly.
responsibility with it as well. Anyway, going back to speculative fiction, because we have wandered off topic a bit
Sorry,
here.
yes, we have.
I think it's interesting because it is all reflected in the stuff we write and the stuff we read. Either there's a need for more of this engagement, or it's reflected as there isn't enough. And again, I can't think of any concrete examples, but you do seem to see in fiction just generally older people as not really fully rounded characters, almost a bit powerless.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be good. Sometimes they can be absolutely horrible, nasty, vicious people. Again, I'd be thinking of Robin Jarvis and the grandmother in the Weird Museum series. Really,
Yeah.
really horribly unpleasant in the Woven Path. And this was the boy gets sent back in time and ends up living with her, and she's just this, she takes vindictive delight in other people's suffering. So this is during the Second World War, and there's bombings and things happening, and what she's really getting out of it is she's enjoying other people suffering. Horrible,
Yeah.
sadistic character.
Yeah.
But you can't say she doesn't have agency.
No. I think, that there are other examples, which is that you get the mental character who, once they have instilled their knowledge, their usefulness dries out and they die.
Yes.
I'm thinking of Yoda. Yoda's a good example. He instills his knowledge and then dies.
He is used to kickstart start Luke into taking responsibility, isn't he? At that point, if we're looking at the original trilogy.
But that the point is that, you know, this yeah he prompts other things to happen, but the point is that yeah he himself as a character didn't have any other use after that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He was used as a device,
Yeah,
which is a shame because he was actually a pretty good character.
yeah. Another example is, oh gosh, what's it called with the blue dragon? Jewels. It was a flop movie, but some good books. You know what I'm talking about.
Not Aragon.
Yes, Aragorn.
I've never actually read those books.
Neither have I, but I saw the movie. And you had pale, pasty white boy with dragon who was mentored by older guy, who was played by a good actor, and older guy installed like lots of wisdom into younger guy who mostly ignored him. Then I think older guy died.
Yeah.
And it was just, there we go. I have now given you everything you need. I've now sort of said everything. My usefulness is only in what I know. And then you die. You're like, come on.
I can kind of see the point in some respects because you need to have that powerful, knowledgeable character to step back and allow the hero to take their place as the main character proper. But at the same time, there are other ways of doing it. You don't have to kill them off, or you don't have to kill them off in an arc that sends the hero careering off, either searching for revenge or meaning or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, the other thing is that they're there and they instill this kind of knowledge, but why do they have to be all knowing?
Yeah,
That
absolutely. They've got to
that's
make.
the only you're like it's all he's all knowing. That's why we had to kill him because otherwise he was too smart. And I'm like, then just don't make him all knowing. It's very simple.
It's like I think they've got to make mistakes or they've got to do what they think is right, but it might not actually be the right thing to do. Which I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but that's kind of what I've done with I Am the Silence, because I've got Mrs. Cranford doing something that ultimately M is going to see a massive betrayal.
Yeah, exactly. And
She's in an impossible situation, but.
the other thing is as well, this idea that you need to kill them off because this character can't now learn anything. And that's stupid. You don't stop learning stuff just because you reach a certain age. So, you know, it would be nice to actually have this character impart all they know to one person, then go, hey, there's still more that we could learn, however, let's continue on together. You know, like, why did you have to kill them?
Yeah, agreed.
I'd love to read a book which is just a, you know, like a grandpa grandson duo or a grandpa a granddaughter duo. That would be awesome. I'd totally be up for that.
Yeah, I think there's things like the glass sentence, but I haven't actually read the book, so I can't comment on it too much.
No, I haven't read that either.
But yeah, time traveling grandfather, granddaughter
Yeah, all for
thing.
that. And there's also this fear of age, which is that, I mean, I kind of get it why they did it in Once Upon a Time, right? Emma gets her parents, but her parents are her age because they haven't aged.
Right, because
And
that's
it
not weird.
So she's there like, oh, dad and stuff like that, and you know you've got like all these characters who are basically all the same age and their parents, and then there's like grandparents start to arrive and you're just there like, what? And it's just this fear of depicting older people. This absolute fear. And you know, to be honest, I share it as well. I was worried about writing older characters for a very long time. I just didn't think I could. And now that I'm getting a little bit older, I'm suddenly going, oh yeah, I could write this character as 35. That's not too old. And that'll continue. I'm so sorry, Jules. I'm so sorry. You know what I mean. But that's the point. You know, when I was 17, I was just there, I've got to make them as young as possible. I've got to make them as young as possible. Otherwise, you know, I can't have them older because, you know, how could I possibly write a character falling in love at that age. No, 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 that would be too embarrassing. They've got to be younger. And now, of course, I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? Of course, you could write a character at any age and they could be going through any form of this kind of development. And I think it's probably I've come to this realization because as I reach adulthood, I realize that no adult is actually an adult. Like, you don't wake up one morning and go, well, I'm an adult now. You kind of wake up one morning and go, so when is this transformation supposed to happen? I still look around for a more adult, you know what I mean? And it's the fact that I tend to think of us as the same age, even though we are not the same age.
No, I don't think you could have underlined that statement much more, but...
It's all right, Jules, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. At some point, you get to an age and you'll just forget that you're getting older. And then one day you'll go, where did the last 20 years go? And films that you thought came out recently actually came out 15 years ago and things like that. But it's fine. You'll realise that actually you don't mind. It doesn't matter.
What's the fact that people are just like, oh, yeah, in 2007, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was like just, you know, 3 years ago. And they're like, that was 10 years ago. And I was like, no, it's not been a decade. It cannot have been a decade. Yeah, it is that realization, that sudden realization that age is an illusion, and that what we're actually basing it on is experience. In that if you are a person who has spent the last 50 years in the same place doing pretty much nothing with no experience, and you happen to meet someone who's, you know, half your age, who's gone all over the world and met lots of people and lots of things, then they might be more of a developed person than you are.
Yeah.
You know, and so this idea that age is the thing that specifies whether you are adventure-worthy material is wrong.
Yeah, what it comes down to is wisdom comes from the use you make of your years and experience, and if you make a bad use or no use of both, then you can't claim any sort of wisdom.
As for the physical aspect of things, which is that, oh, they can't be adventurers because they don't have, you know, the physical... But I don't know, I think that would kind of add to the story, which is that I've got to go and fight orcs and stuff like that, but, you know, like, I have a really bad hit. Like, I wouldn't mind seeing someone have to use their brain and stuff like that to try and get past all these problems.
Yeah.
It would be interesting, instead of just having a young, nubile young man who is somehow specifically trained advantageously and very fit and able to do all of the stuff naturally. Like, it would actually be quite good if you had someone who just goes, oh, bugger it.
Or the ubiquitous, helpless female protagonist who is oh so plain but also gorgeous and also... You know, she's really clumsy, except when she's learning all these different martial arts, which she's just got a real flair for.
Yeah, I'm really clumsy, except for when I'm killing people. Yeah.
But a good example, I suppose, is back to Diana Wynne Jones, is Howl's Moving Castle. Now, Sophie, the main character, isn't old, but she has a curse cast on her that makes her about 90 years old.
Yeah.
So you've got a young person in an old person's body, and obviously there's a lot of mental gymnastics going on there, because part of Sophie is the fact that she's become a bit isolated and reclusive, and being old and being perceived as someone who isn't desirable actually frees her in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So it makes for a really interesting hero's journey. And, you know, she's obviously not in a good state. She has heart arrhythmias and things like that at the beginning of the book, until Hal sort of quietly sorts them out. And problems with her joints and getting around. The sort of things you'd expect in your 90s.
Yeah.
So it's all things that can be woven into a story to improve it.
And it can be woven into a story restfully. Now, obviously, the end of Howl's Moving Castle is that she turns back into a young woman, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She basically embraces the fact that it's, you know, that she's not any safer being old than she is young, that it's dangerous no matter what she does, and she lets go of the curse.
Yeah, but I just think it... And I think that the problem with that, well, it's not a problem because that's what she was originally, is that the answer to being old isn't to be young. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I see.
Sorry, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You don't need to just to say, if you are writing about an older person, the resolve doesn't need to be, and then they live forever, or, and then they drank from the fountain of youth and became young and nubile or anything
Yeah.
like that.
It doesn't need to be a magical cup of Isha type story,
Yeah.
whereby
I
everybody
mean,
gets their youth back and their mistakes are unmade. I think it says a lot more if you can continue from that point. Obviously, in Sophie's case, she does actually complete her hero's journey because she realizes that, you know what, it's worth endangering her heart for some things, which is what the whole
yeah.
letting a curse go and, you know, becoming someone who's desirable is about.
Yeah. And as we say, she wasn't actually an old woman to begin with. She was just kind of disguising herself as one in many ways, hiding behind this what she perceived to be the safety of being older.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting phenomena how we write and how we perceive older characters. So on that note, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.